They squinted into the alley, once again revealing themselves as newcomers to the city. More Porkians don't look down dark alleys when they hear strange noises. If they see four struggling figures, their first instinct is not to rush to anyone's assistance. Or at least, not to rush to the assistance of the one who appears to be losing and on the wrong end of someone else's boot. Nor do they shout, "Oi!" Above all, they don't look surprised when the assailants, instead of guiltily running off, flourish a small piece of cardboard in front of them.
"What's this?" said Tom John. "It's a clown," said Howell. "They've mugged a clown."
"Theft license," said Tom John, holding the card up to the light.
"That's right," said the leader of the three. "Only don't expect us to do you two, 'cause we're on our way home."
"Right," said one of the assistants. "It's the thingy, the quarter."
"But you were kicking him."
"Well, not a lot. Not what you'd call actual kicking. More foot nudging sort of thing," said the third thief. "Fair's fair. He bloody well went and fetched Ron here a right thump, didn't he?"
"Yeah, some people have no idea."
"Why, you heartless—"
Howell began, but Tom John laid a cautioning hand on his head. The boy turned the card over. The obverse read,
"J.H. Flannelfoot, Boggis and Nephews, Bespoke Thieves, The Old Firm, established A.M. 1789. All type theft carried out professionally and with discretion. Houses cleared, 24-hour service, no job too small. Let us quote you for our family rate."
"It seems to be an order," he said reluctantly. Howell paused in the act of helping the dazed victim to his feet.
"In order," he shouted, "to rob someone?"
"We'll give him a chitty, of course," said Boggis. "Lucky we found him first, really. Some of these newcomers in the business, they've got no idea."
"Cowboys,"
agreed a nephew. Ankh Morpork's enviable system of licensed criminals owes much to the current patrician, Lord Vetinari. He reasoned that the only way to police a city of 1 million inhabitants was to recognize the various gangs and robbers' guilds, give them professional status, invite the leaders to large dinners, allow an acceptable level of street crime, and then make the guild leaders responsible for enforcing it, on pain of being stripped of their new civic honours, along with large areas of their skin. It worked. Criminals, it turned out, made a very good police force. Unauthorised robbers soon found, for example, that instead of a night in the cells, they could now expect an eternity at the bottom of the river. However, there was the problem of apportioning the crime statistics. And so there arose a complex system of annual budgeting, chits and allowances to see that A, the members could make a reasonable living, and B, no citizen was robbed or assaulted more than an agreed number of times. Many foresighted citizens, in fact, arranged to get an acceptable minimum of theft, assault, etc., over at the beginning of the financial year, often in the privacy and comfort of their own homes, and thus be able to walk the streets quite safely for the rest of the year. It all ticked over extremely peacefully and efficiently, demonstrating once again that, compared to the patrician of Ankh, Machiavelli could not have run a whelk stall.
"How much did you steal?"
said Tom John. Boggis opened the clown's purse, which was stuck in his belt, then went pale.
"Oh, bleeding hell," he said.
The nephews clustered around.
"We're for it, sort of thing."
"Second time this year, Uncle."
Boggis glared at the victim.
"Well, how was I to know? I wasn't to know, was I? I mean, look at him. How much would you expect him to have on him? Couple of coppers, right? I mean, we'd never have done him, only it was on our way home. You try to do someone a favour, this is what happens."
"How much has he got, then?"
said Tom John.
"There must be 100 silver dollars in here," moaned Boggis, waving a purse. "I mean, that's not my league. That's not my class. I can't handle that sort of money. You've got to be in the guild of lawyers or something to steal that much. It's way over my quota as that.
Give it back then, said Tom John.
But I done him a receipt.
They've all got, you know, numbers on,
explained the younger of the nephews.
The girl checks up, sort of.
Howell grabbed Tom John's hand.
Will you excuse us a moment?
He said to the frantic thief, and dragged Tom John to the other side of the alley.
Okay,
he said.
Who's gone mad? Them? Me? You?
Tom John explained.
It's legal.
Up to a certain point. Fascinating, isn't it? Man in a pub told me about it, sort of thing.
But he's stolen too much.
So it appears. I gather the guild is very strict about it.
There was a groan from the victim hanging between them. He tinkled gently.
Look after him, said Tom John. I'll sort this out.
He went back to the thieves, who were looking very worried.
My client feels, he said, that the situation could be resolved if you give the money back.
Yes, said Boggis,
approaching the idea as if it were a brand new theory of cosmic creation.
But it's the receipt, see? We have to fill it up, time and place signed and everything.
My client feels that possibly you could rob him of, let us say, 5 copper pieces,
said Tom John smoothly.
I bloody don't,
shouted the fool who was coming round.
That represents 2 copper pieces as the going rate, plus expenses of 3 copper pieces for time, call-out fees.
Wear and tear on Kosh, said Boggis.
Exactly.
Very fair, very fair.
Boggis looked over Tom John's head at the fool, who was now completely conscious and very angry.
Very fair, he said loudly. Statesmanlike, much obliged, I'm sure.
He looked down at Tom John.
And anything for yourself, sir?
He added.
Just say the word. We've got a special on GBH this season, practically painless. You'll barely fear a thing. Hardly breaks the skin, said the older nephew. Plus you get a choice of limb.
I believe I'm well served in that area, said Tom John smoothly.
Oh, well. Right, yeah, then, no problem.
Which merely leaves,
continued Tom John, as the thieves started to walk away,
the question of legal fees.
The gentle greyness at the stump of the night flowed across Ankh-Morpork. Tom John and Howell sat on either side of the table in their lodgings, counting. 3 silver dollars and 18 copper pieces in profit, I make it, said Tom John.
That was amazing, said the fool. I mean, the way they volunteered to go home and get some more money as well, after you gave them that speech about the rights of man.
He dabbed some more ointment on his head.
And the youngest one started to cry,
he added.
Amazing!
It wears off,
said Howell.
You're a dwarf, aren't you?
Howell didn't feel he could deny this.
I can tell you're a fool, he said.
Yes, it's the bells, isn't it?
Said the fool wearily, rubbing his ribs.
Yes, and the bells.
Tom John grimaced and kicked Howell under the table.
Well, I'm very grateful, said the fool.
He stood up and winced.
I'd really like to show my gratitude, he said. Is there a tavern open around here?
Tom John joined him at the window and pointed down the length of the street.
See all those tavern signs, he said.
Yes, gosh, there's hundreds.
Right, see the one at the end? With the blue and white sign?
Yes, I think so.
Well, as far as I know, that's the only one around here that's ever closed.
Then pray allow me to treat you to a drink. It's the least I can do, said the fool nervously. And I'm sure the little fellow would like something to quaff.
Howell gripped the edge of the table and opened his mouth to roar, and stopped. He stared at the two figures. His mouth stayed open. It closed again with a snap.
Something the matter? Said Tom John. Howell looked away. It had been a long night.
"Trigger the light," he muttered. "And I could do with a drink," he added. "A bloody good quaff."
In fact, he thought, why fight it?
"I'll even put up with the singing," he said.
"What was the next word? Scold, I think. Oh."
Howell looked unsteadily into his mug. Drunkenness had this to be said for it. It stopped the flow of inspirations.
"And you left out the gold," he said.
"Well, yeah,"
said Tom John. He was wearing the fool's hat. Howell considered this.
"I reckon," he said,
concentrating,
"it was between the gold and the gold. And I reckon..."
He peered again into the mug. It was empty, a horrifying sight.
"I reckon..."
He tried again and finally gave up and substituted,
"I reckon I could do with another drink."
"My shout this time,"
said the fool.
"My squeak."
He tried to stand up and banged his head. In the gloom of the bar, a dozen axes were gripped more firmly. The part of Howell that was sober, and was horrified to see the rest of him being drunk, urged him to wave his hand at the beetling brows glaring at him through the gloom.
"It's all right,"
he said to the bar at large.
"He don't mean it. He's very funny, what's name? Idiot. Fool. Very funny fool. All the way from, what's his place?
Lancre,"
said the fool, and sat down heavily on the bar.
"That's right. Long way away from what's name. Sounds like a foot disease. Don't know how to behave. Don't know many dwarfs."
Said the fool, clutching his head.
"Bit short of them where I come from."
Someone tapped Howell on the shoulder. He turned and looked into a craggy, hairy face under an iron helmet. The dwarf in question was tossing a throwing axe up and down in a meaningful way.
"You ought to tell your friend to be a bit less funny," he suggested. "Otherwise he'll be amusing the demons in hell."
Howell squinted at him through an alcoholic haze.
"How are you?"
he said.
"Grabpot Thundergast," said the dwarf, striking his chainmail torso. "And I say..."
Howell peered closer.
"Here, I know you," he said. "You got a cosmetics mill down up Fast Street. I bought a lot of grease paint off you last week."
A look of panic crossed Thundergast's face. He leaned forward in panic.
"Shut up. Shut up," he whispered. "That's right. It said, the Halls of Elvin Perfume and Rouge Co.,"
said Howell happily.
"Very good stuff,"
said Tom John, who was trying to stop himself from sliding off a tiny bench.
"Especially your number 19, Corpse Green. My father swears it's the best, first class."
The dwarf hefted his axe uneasily.
"Weller," he said. "Oh, but, yes, well, thank you. Only the finest ingredients, mark you."
"Chop them up with it, do you?"
said Howell innocently, pointing to the axe.
"Or is it your night off?"
Thundergast's brow beetled again like a cockroach convention.
"Here, you're not with the theatre."
"There's us,"
said Tom John.
"Strolling players,"
he corrected himself.
"Standing still players now." "Sliding down players now."
The dwarf dropped his axe and sat down on the bench, his face suddenly softened with enthusiasm.
"I went last week," he said. "Bloody good it was. There was this girl and this fella, but she was married to this old man.
and there was this other fella, and they said he died, and she pined away and took poison. And then it turned out this man was the other man, really, only he couldn't tell her on account of...
Thundergust stopped and blew his nose.
"Everyone died in the end,"
he said.
"Very tragic. I cried all the way home. I don't mind telling you. She was so pale."
"Number 19 and a layer of powder," said Tom John cheerfully. "Plus a bit of brown eyeshadow.
Eh?
And a couple of hankies in the vest," he added.
"What's he saying?"
said the dwarf to the company at, for want of a better word, large. Howell smiled into his tankard.
"Give him a bit of Gretelina's soliloquy, boy," he said.
"Right."
Tom John stood up, hit his head, sat down, and then knelt on the floor as a compromise. He clasped his hands to what would have been, but for a few chance chromosomes, his bosom.
"You lie who call it summer," he began.
The assembled dwarfs listened in silence for several minutes. One of them dropped his axe and was noisily hushed by the rest of them.
"And melting snow, farewell."
Tom John finished.
"Drinks, Foyle. Collapses behind battlements. Down ladder, out of dress, into tabard for comic guard number 2. Wait. Entrance left."
"What? Ho?
Good.
That's about enough,"
said Howell quietly. Several of the dwarfs were crying into their helmets. There was a chorus of blown noses. Thundergust dabbed at his eye with a chainmail handkerchief.
"That was the most saddest thing I've ever heard,"
he said. He glared at Tom John.
"Hang on,"
he said. A realization dawned.
"He's a man. I bloody fell in love with that girl on stage."
He nudged Howell.
"He's not a bit of an elf, is he?"
"Absolutely human,"
said Howell.
"I know his father."
Once again, he stared hard at the fool, who was watching them with his mouth open, and looked back at Tom John. He thought.
"Coincidence."
"It's acting,"
he said.
"A good actor can be anything, right?"
He could feel the fool's eye boring into the back of his short neck.
"Yes, but dressing up as women, it's a bit..."
said Thundergust doubtfully. Tom John slipped off his shoes and knelt down on them, bringing his face level with the dwarf's. He gave him a calculating stare for a few seconds, and then adjusted his features. And there were 2 Thundergusts. True, one of them was kneeling, and had apparently been shaved.
"What ho! What ho!"
said Tom John in the dwarf's voice. This was by way of being a hilarious gag to the rest of the dwarfs, who had an uncomplicated sense of humour. As they gathered round the pair, Howell felt a gentle touch on the shoulder.
"You two are with the theatre,"
said the fool, now almost sober.
"That's right."
"Then I've come 500 miles to find you."
It was, as Hal would have noted in his stage directions, later the same day. The sound of hammering as the Disc Theatre rose from its cradle of scaffolding thumped through Howell's head and out the other side. He could remember the drinking, he was certain, and the dwarfs brought lots more rounds when Tom John did his impersonations. Then they had all gone to another bar, Thundergust knew, and then they had gone to a Clatchan takeaway, and after that, it was just a blur. He wasn't very good at quaffing. Too much of the drink actually landed in his mouth. Judging by the taste in it, some incontinent creature of the night had also scored a direct hit.
"Can you do it?"
said Vitola. Howell smacked his lips to get rid of the taste.
"I expect,"
said Tom John.
"It sounded interesting, the way he told it. Wicked kings ruling with the help of evil witches, storms, ghastly forests, true heir to throne in life and death struggle, flash of dagger, screams, alarums, evil king dies, good triumphs, bells ring out."
Showers of rose petals can be arranged, said Vitola. I know a man who can get them at practically cost.
They both looked at Howell, who was drumming his fingers on his stool. All three found their attention drawn to the bag of silver the fool had given Howell. Even by itself, it represented enough money to complete the disc. And there had been talk of more to follow. Patronage, that was the thing.
You will do it, then, will you?
Said Vitola.
It's got a certain something,
Howell conceded.
I don't know.
I'm not trying to pressure you, said Vitola.
All three pairs of eyes swiveled back to the money bag.
It seems a bit fishy, Tom John conceded. I mean, the fool is decent enough, but the way he tells it, it's very odd. His mouth says the words, and his eyes say something else. And I got the impression he'd much rather we believed his eyes.
On the other hand, said Vitola hurriedly, what harm could it do? The pay's the thing.
Howell raised his head.
What?
He said, muzzily.
I said the play's the thing, said Vitola.
There was silence again, except for the drumming of Howell's fingertips. The bag of silver seemed to have grown larger. In fact, it seemed to fill the room.
The thing is,
Vitola began unnecessarily loudly.
The way I see it,
Howell began. They both stopped.
After you, sorry.
It wasn't important. Go ahead.
I was going to say, we could afford to build a disc anyway, said Howell.
Just the shell and the stage, said Vitola. But not all the other things. Not the trapdoor mechanism, or the machine for lowering gods out of heaven, or the big turntable, or the wind fans.
We used to manage without all that stuff, said Howell.
Remember the old days? All we had was a few planks and a bit of painted sacking. But we had a lot of spirit. If we wanted wind, we had to make it ourselves.
He drummed his fingers for a while. Of course, he added quietly.
We should be able to afford a wave machine. A small one. I've got this idea about this ship wrecked on an island. Where there is this...
Sorry.
Vitola shook his head.
But we've had some huge audiences, said Tom John.
Sure, lad, sure. But they pay in halfpennies. The artificers want silver. If we wanted to be rich men, people,
he corrected hurriedly,
we should have been born carpenters.
Vitola shifted uneasily.
I already owe Christopher's the troll more than I should.
The other two stared.
He's the one that has people's limbs torn off, said Tom John.
How much do you owe him?
Said Howell.
It's all right, said Vitola hurriedly. I'm keeping up the interest payments, more or less.
Yes, but how much does he want?
An arm and a leg.
The dwarf and the boy stared at him in horror.
How could you have been so...
I did it for you two. Tom John deserves a better stage. He doesn't want to go ruining his health, sleeping in lattice, and never knowing a home. And you, my man, you need somewhere settled, with all the proper things you ought to have, like trapdoors and wave machines and so forth. You talked me into it, and I thought, they're right. It's no life on the road, giving two performances a day to a bunch of farmers and going round with a hat afterwards. What sort of future is that? I thought, we've got to get a place somewhere, with comfortable seats for the gentry, people who don't throw potatoes at the stage. I said, blow the cost, I just wanted you to...
all right,
said Howell.
I'll write it.
I'll act it,
said Tom John.
I'm not forcing you, mind,
said Vitola.
It's your own choice.
Howell frowned at the table. There were, he had to admit, some nice touches. Three witches was good. Two wouldn't be enough. Four would be too many.
They could be meddling with the destinies of mankind and everything. Lots of smoke and green light. You could do a lot with three witches. It was surprising no one had thought of it before.
So we can tell this fool that we'll do it, can we?
Said Vitola, his hand on the bag of silver. And of course you couldn't go wrong with a good storm. And there was the ghost routine that Vitola had cut out of Please Yourself, saying that they couldn't afford the muslin. And perhaps he could put death in, too. Young Daffy would make a damn good death, with white makeup and platform soles.
How far away did he say he'd come from?
He said.
The Ram Tops, said the playmaster. Some little kingdom no one's ever heard of sounds like a chest infection.
It'd take months to get there.
I'd like to go anyway, said Tom John. That's where I was born. Vitola looked at the ceiling. Howell looked at the floor. Anything was better just at that moment than looking at each other's face.
That's what you said, said the boy. When you did a tour of the mountains, you said.
Yes, but I can't remember where, said Vitola. All those little mountain towns look the same to me. We spent more time pushing the Latty across rivers and dragging them up hills than we ever did on the stage.
I could take some of the younger lads, and we could make a summer of it, said Tom John. Put on all the old favourites. And we could still be back by Soul Cake Day. You could stay here and see to the theatre, and we could be back for a grand opening. He grinned at his father.
It'd be good for them, he said slyly. You always said some of the young lads don't know what a real acting life is like.
Howell's still got to write the play, Vitola
pointed out. Howell was silent. He was staring at nothing at all. After a while, one hand fumbled in his doublet and brought out a sheaf of paper, and then disappeared in the direction of his belt and produced a small corked inkpot and a bundle of quills. They watched as, without once looking at them, the dwarf smoothed out the paper, opened the inkpot, dipped a quill, held it poised like a hawk waiting for its prey, and then began to write. Vitola nodded at Tom John. Walking as quietly as they could, they left the room. Around mid-afternoon, they took up a tray of food and a bundle of paper. The tray was still there at tea-time. The paper had gone. A few hours later, a passing member of the company reported hearing a yell of,
"It can't work! It's back to front!"
and the sound of something being thrown across the room. Around supper, Vitola heard a shouted request for more candles and fresh quills. Tom John tried to get an early night, but sleep was murdered by the sound of creativity from the next room. There were mutterings about balconies and whether the world really needed wave machines. The rest was silent, except for the insistent scratching of quills. Eventually, Tom John dreamed.
"Now, have we got everything this time?"
"Yes, Granny."
"Light the fire, Magrat."
"Yes, Granny."
"Right. Let's see now."
"I wrote it all down, Granny."
"I can read, my girl, thank you very much. Now, what's this? Round about the cauldron go, in the poisoned entrails throw. What are these supposed to be?"
"Oh, Jason slaughtered a pig yesterday, Esme."
"These look like perfectly good chitterlings to me, Gaither. There's a couple of decent meals in them, if I'm any judge."
"Please, Granny."
"There's plenty of starving people in Clatch who wouldn't turn up their nose at 'em, that's all I'm saying." "All right, all right. Whole grain wheat and lentils, too, in the cauldron seethe and stew. What happened to the toad?"
"Please, Granny, you're slowing it down. You know Goody was against all unnecessary cruelty. Vegetable protein is a perfectly acceptable substitute."
"That means no newt or fenny snake either, I suppose."
"No, Granny."
"Or tiger's children?"
"Here."
"What the hell's this? Excuse my clatching."
"It's a tiger's children, Our Wayne bought it off a merchant from Fawn Parts.
You sure?
Our Wayne, our special Esme.
Looks like any other children to me. Oh, well. Double hubbles, double trouble, fire burn and cauldron bu- Why isn't the cauldron bubbling, McGrat?